Hi, I'm Ron Coleman, a partner in the Dillon Law Group, social media legend and free speech enthusiast. When I started the Coleman Nation podcast in the spring of 2021, its focus was on free expression and censorship on the internet. But as important as that subject is to me, which is very important, I felt hemmed in the podcast. I wanted to spend more time talking to the interesting people I've met in my legal and free speech work without feeling a need to have them all make the same point. So I culminated the first series of the podcast and have started the second series. I hope you'll enjoy these conversations as much as I have recording them. Hey, Culminators, how are you? Thanks for joining me today. Today, we're going to talk to one of those people that I am not going to tell you I've been friends with on the internet for a long, long time, and we finally meet in person, and or have never met in person, or something like that. No, Jeremy and I met in person a few years ago, where we had a super secret meeting in a super secret location, talking about, he said, here's the thing about Jeremy Carl, you're going to come to understand. He's one of those guys who is pulling the strings behind the scene. He was at the Hoover Institute for a long time. He's one of these think tank guys. He's at Claremont now, which is the, remember Hoover used to be the place for Illuminati? Now it's Claremont, okay? So keep an eye on Jeremy Carl. And he has a new book, which, I mean, the fact is, I really should have and meant to have him on the show a long time ago. He's a super, super good guy. But now he wrote this book, The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. Believe it or not, I intend to ask him some questions. And, you know, I want to hear more than the title and more than the headline, because we kind of know what's going on. But Jeremy's going to give us the deep dive. Jeremy, welcome to Coleman Nation podcast.
Thanks, Ron. It's a pleasure to be on.
Good to see you again. We were just joking before we started officially recording that you're speaking to us through the good graces of Elon Musk's satellite internet connection from Bozeman, Montana. And I joke to you, why, however, is it so necessary for you to be in Bozeman, Montana? You show me a picture of the beautiful mountain range out your window. But all right, but that's fine. But how'd you end up? Seriously, how did it happen? You're not from there.
No, my wife and I were fortunate. We had been living in California for a number of years, and I'd been working at the Hoover Institution, which was it was a great place. As you know, the Illuminati have spent some time out there in the past before they migrated to Claremont, and the job was great, but. We had five school age kids, and I know you have a number of kids yourself, Ron, so you probably appreciate this. This just wasn't, although there are many nice things about Palo Alto where we were, it just wasn't the sort of environment that I ultimately wanted to raise my kids in.
When did you leave Palo Alto?
When did I leave Palo Alto? We left in 2019.
Okay, because I have a son who lives in Palo Alto.
Ah.
And who is about to leave Palo Alto for the same reason,
yeah.
Except four kids, not five so far. So, yeah, I get that. Leaving Palo Alto, but you're really kind of backing into the answer. I understand why a reasonable person would leave Palo Alto.
Sure.
Why would you land in Bozeman, Montana?
Well, we're both very outdoorsy. We had some connections out here, not like super tight, but we did know a few folks. We were looking for kind of a place that would be sort of remote and isolated, both because of personal preference of just kind of how we like to live and being. And we, as you saw when I showed you, we're right up in the mountains where we are. I actually don't live in town. I live about 10 minutes north of Bozeman. But it was a place that kind of had a friendly small town feel, and a really interesting state, a conservative state, that was important to me as we were thinking about picking. And so we just wound up here.
But you got your undergraduate at Yale, and you got your master's at Kennedy School at Harvard, and then you went on to Stanford. How are you a conservative after these experiences?
Well, I think maybe you sort of get inoculated, right? You sort of go either direction. You have when you have that much exposure to the liberal mind virus, You either just totally get taken over by it, or you develop a lot of disease resistance. And in my case, I developed a lot of disease resistance. And I think part of my thinking was also that I was concerned about that for my kids, right? They were being raised in this liberal mind virus area. And I'm like, well, I made it out alive, but I'm not sure that my kids are going to make it out alive.
In fact, I would posit another outcome, which is that you become a real reactionary.
Yeah.
Because that's what I saw on the part of my son, who you know, has to still, given his public education position in Palo Alto, needs to keep it on the down low. But boy, has he become a black-hearted right winger. Because just, you know, just living through that sort of Portlandia-esque sort of life has just... Okay, but now back to the serious stuff. I assume you're happy you made the move.
Yes, absolutely. It's been great. And I think it's also been great for our kids. They've been exposed to a lot of stuff that, I mean, certainly we can still offer them the sorts of things that, you know, fancy Ivy League educated parents, et cetera, can offer, but they're also just exposed to a lot more diversity of ideas and experiences in the true sense of that word, not in the kind of racial bean counting sense of that word, than they would have had we stayed in the more nominally diverse city of Palo Alto. And so that's been really neat to see.
Oh yeah. So your wife is also one of those?
Yes, my wife was a college classmate.
Oh my. So you were like the last heterosexual couple to graduate from Yale.
Yes, something like that.
I mean, this is what we said at Princeton, mind you, in the 80s.
Yeah.
Okay. Now you're really living the dream. I mean, I didn't listen. I love the great outdoors when I find myself there. I am a city cat, however. I can't imagine. Well, of course, also because of my religious needs. It's not about me. This, no one's tuning in to hear about me. Okay, let's talk about this book. The Unprotected: White Racism is Tearing America Apart. What is it? When did you start on this? I mean, this is sort of a piece of what a lot of people are writing about and observing, what has been in our faces for the last couple of years. And to me, it was such a turning point, that snarky MTV Dear White People video, a Christmas of what, 2021, was it?
Sure.
It was so, actually, no. Now, you know, you're a scholar, you've got all kinds of degrees from the fanciest. Let me just ask you a quick question before we move on. Are Jews white?
Great
Look
question.
Look me in the face and answer me that question.
A great question. I mean, I think certainly constitutionally and within the American system, they always have been. That's how they've been treated. I think that it is fair to see Jews as white, but it's also fair at times to analyze them differently in terms of in certain political situations, right? Yeah, so they're going to be treated as white by the law, but they're going to also have different, and in fact, with the majority of community, often quite politically unhelpful from my perspective and yours, situations on these issues. So
yeah, no, I know. And then, so, okay, now back to your answer to the question.
Yeah.
What is it that, what was the moment and what was it that said, that made you say you could do something different with this piece?
Well, it's a really good question, Ron. And there's a couple different answers to it. The kind of quick nominal answer is I started writing this book about a year and a half ago. The longer answer is this was a book that I thought about for years. And actually, I think you'll appreciate this analogy. And by this, I, of course, don't imply personal comparison. But it was a little bit like when God kind of came to Moses and said, you know, we want you to lead. And he's like, no, you know, my brother Aaron is much more eloquent. He tries to argue with God about it, right? And say, really, somebody else should do this. And that's kind of what I felt like, because I think, A, when you take on a really freighted issue like that, there's going to be baggage, there's going to be hits. And I've had a few of these already in my life, but this is going to bring...
Is freighted a form of fraught?
Yeah, maybe I should say fraught. I'm not sure used that. Maybe I've used that term incorrectly, but if it's
I mean, you can take it out. Let's look it up. I don't want to embarrass you. Cause I just thought I thought maybe I learned something.
It's when you take on an issue like this, that is just has a lot of baggage associated with it.
Yeah. It's fraught.
It's fraught. You don't want to immediately jump in there. And so I kept hoping somebody else, including other people who'd written books in kind of not this area, because I don't think anybody has quite sort of put all their cards on the table quite like this, at least in the mainstream publication world and the mainstream think tank world. But I'd sort of hope somebody else would do it. And at some point, you know, God was like, no, Moses, it's you, you know, with all of your failures and everything else and lack of abilities for X or Y or Z. If you want to see this done, you got to write this book. And so that's what it really came down to.
In fact, I do know about you that you've never been one to thrust yourself out and make it about your personality. So you must have indeed felt that it was a calling. It was a mission that you had been entrusted with. And I get that. And I understand that that's the extent of your comparison to Moses. But I will also make the comparison of that you are a very humble man and also tall. Which, you know, the rabbis tell us Moses was a lot taller than Charlton Heston even. Okay. So you got to work on it. You pitched it. You have an agent? Do you have an agent?
I decided to not use an agent. I did think about it, and I had a couple recommended to me, but I actually went directly to Regnery. And the reason why I did that was because I felt like with a controversial subject like this, it was really important to have a conservative publisher that would stand behind me and not kind of try to make me change things for palatability. So I went directly to Regnery. I didn't shop it to anywhere else. I wasn't looking to kind of maximize my advance or anything like that. And I was fortunate that Tom Spence, who was the head of Regnery at the time, did take the book and actually gave me a kind of nice advance. And then sort of ironically and unfortunately, right as I was about to go to press, Regnery was actually bought by another publisher, Skyhorse, out of New York. And actually they have been great to work with. They didn't touch any of the content in any sort of negative way. So it ended up working out fine. But my book had already been pretty much in the can at that point. So that may have had something to do with it.
So what surprised you in the process of undertaking this? Again, the thesis, which I assume ends up being proved, I think, over the course of the book, is right there in the title and the subtitle. Someone actually on a live stream asked me a question about protected classes or suspect classes.
Yeah.
And thought that they were under the impression that it was some sort of discriminatory concept, and I explained that it is inherently built into the anti-discrimination laws. They have to apply to certain classes, but as you point out, when it comes to whites, that's a little bit more. So before we get to answering my question, why don't you explain for the non-lawyer listener what your title is alluding to?
Sure. Yeah, and I should add that I'm not a lawyer either. So if I use it slightly imprecisely, I'm sure you can correct me. But basically, within civil rights law, there is a concept of protected classes, and that can include gender and sexual orientation and all sorts of other things. But the kind of primary one that we think about is race. And if you have those, you're sort of protected from certain types of discrimination under civil rights law. And actually, nominally, this is kind of an important point to make. Whites are a protected class racially in theory, okay? But in practice, it hasn't worked that way at all. And so that's kind of where it came from, this idea of the unprotected class. And, you know, I think one thing that's actually been encouraging is that we're beginning to see a few smaller conservative legal groups. And I would think, I don't know that your firm has done anything in this particular micro area yet, but certainly you've been around the edges of this in other areas. And if you look at folks like America First Legal, who are beginning to look at some of the more outrageous anti-white discrimination that's just been going on in front of our faces for years, and beginning to sue and actually beginning to get some victories and hopefully some really big payouts over this. So I'm hopeful that in writing this book and talking about it and putting it more front and center, that some of the more blatantly illegal anti-white discrimination that we have out in the country is going to begin to get pulled back, because it's illegal. That's the bottom line.
It is. And it's probably more illegal than it was when you started writing this book.
Yes. Yeah, that's actually been a nice thing, is that there was definitely some parts of this book that when I started a year and a half ago, I'm like, whoa, this is a really narrow tightrope and there doesn't seem to be a net beneath me. And that kind of tightrope has gotten wider, and the appearance of a net has maybe appeared in a few areas. I'm definitely pushing the envelope in what I'm doing still. I'm not saying that it's not, but definitely the kind of notion that mainstream conservative figures, even just in the last year and a half, are more comfortable in kind of calling out some of this anti-white discrimination and this racism.
But the Supreme Court, though, of course.
Court on the education system, although they narrowed that in ways that made me kind of nervous. And Alito and Thomas, of course, dissented. And I do worry that this is kind of the next whack-a-mole that we're going to be dealing with, which is the left is just going to use proxies to continue to discriminate against whites. And the Supreme Court did not have the full courage of its convictions, as Alito wanted them to do, to just totally strike this down and say,
surprised Alito hasn't strangled Roberts by now. Except I guess as long as a Democrat is in office, he's safe. Certainly as long as the Democrats control the Senate. Yeah. But I want to take a step back. I think I know what you mean, but again, tell us about that tightrope.
Well, I think, there's just...
To me, it connects to what you said a second ago, which was, it's illegal, but...
Right. Well, it's illegal, and it also transcends legal. And in fact, I sort of struggled with, did I want to call this anti-white discrimination or anti-white racism in the title? Because some of it is simply discriminatory, and it's very formal, okay? And it's legal, and it's the sort of stuff that you're very, very familiar with, and you and Harmeet and your firm deal with all the time in your work. But then there's a lot of stuff that I talk about in the book, particularly when I get to chapters on Hollywood or even elements of the business world, where discrimination it's much more kind of, it's not that you can point to some legal thing where it's clearly illegal, but that or education would be even in a bigger area, where there are certain anti-white norms being enforced that don't necessarily get into what might make a legal element of a discrimination case you'd win, but are clearly racist. And so at various times you're talking about either one of those two things.
Are either one of those among the surprises that I interrupted you before you had the chance to answer?
No, I mean, I think in terms of the tightrope, I think it's just that I wanted to do a book that would really be for a mainstream audience to educate themselves. And a mainstream right-leaning audience for sure. But I didn't want to write something that was so esoteric that it would be just the sort of thing that folks like you who know all about discrimination law would be the people who would appreciate it. Or I didn't want to write something that was kind of some proto-white nationalist text about how we should, go do anything like that. I wanted to write a book to say, discriminating against white people should be a thing that is very mainstream to oppose and say is wrong in this country. Right.
Let me ask you something. I've struggled with this, and I've argued the other side of, or a surprising perspective, I think, on this. I think it is not an unreasonable position to take that there could be room in social relations, and that's a very broad category.
Sure.
But I'm trying to elide legal versus non-legal. It could include things that the law would address, but more generally, let's say, for example, someone like me, if I see a black conservative on Twitter, I'm more likely to be interested in following him or her than the roughly equivalent white conservative, because I think it's cool and I think it's interesting. And I want to give that person a voice. And I think it, all the reasons, if you show preferences or give an advantage or take affirmative action, small a,
yeah,
to minorities, is that racism? Is that just
right? Well, I think this is why it's important to have a distinction between discrimination and racism, right? Because it's not necessarily racist to do that, even if I might think that in a formal setting it should be illegal. But in your informal setting of who you choose to highlight on Twitter, I think that's your right. And in fact, I even talk about this briefly in the book, this distinction between a private sphere and a public sphere is really important. And Leo Strauss, who is kind of not the direct progenitor of Claremont, but the kind of indirect through his student Jaffa, gave a really important speech on this in the early 1960s, where he sort of said, when you collapse all of these distinctions between public and private, he was actually arguing for why private discrimination, and he gave this talk to B'nai B'rith, but he was saying even against Jews should be allowed in his mind. He said, when you collapse public and private completely, you end up in a totalitarian state. And he, as a refugee from Nazism, appreciated this very distinctly. So well, that's kind of an advanced argument. It's not the core of what I'm talking about in the book, but I do think that it's relevant. And in fact, it's kind of interesting you mentioned this question of Black conservative, because this is maybe the downside of this. A number of people, even sympathetic folks who I talked about with this book, when I was kind of thinking about it first, said, hey, this is great. I'm so glad that somebody's going to write this book, but really, like, a white guy shouldn't write this book. And I actually wanted to push back against that, because my view is, like, if white people are not are too afraid to be able to take their own side in their own cause here and say that this is wrong and this discrimination is happening against white people and it's wrong, you're already admitting defeat right out the door. And it's not that I object in any way. I love having a multiracial group of conservatives push back on this. That's great. And I do have a multiracial list of endorsers, et cetera, on the book. So I'm trying to reach out and not just write something that would just be of interest to white people. But I think that it's important that we're not too broad.
Which is a truly preposterous concept. That's a ridiculous concept. Well, I mean, that we accept these categorizations of humanity.
Yeah.
That's only what white people would be interested in that.
Right.
You've gone to elite schools, you've met, you know, people of every race, pattern, creed, and they cross all kinds of lines, but we're not even going to have that discussion because that's obvious.
Yeah, of course.
But here's another question. It's related. Isn't there a difference between racism directed towards a minority? And this is a moral / policy question, not a legal
one. Sure.
But it probably should have since our lawmakers and judges are operating in that realm, it's relevant as well. Shouldn't there be a difference between racism directed towards a minority, especially one that has been oppressed,
sure,
and the majority, which includes, but is not really made up of, but includes descendants of the oppressors? I mean, let's just do the first half of the question, because I don't even want to talk about inherited guilt.
That's right. I think inherited concept. Guilt is a very problematic concept. So I would definitely, we could push back and have an interesting discussion about that. But I think
it's preposterous.
What you're talking about, this is an important distinction to make. And I think part of the reason, and I kind of explore a little bit in the beginning of the book, like, why have white people been so complacent about this? And I kind of talk about a little bit of almost a noblesse oblige among white people historically, and kind of thinking, well, hey, we are just running the show, and it would almost be tacky to mention that we're being discriminated against. And I think that just no longer describes the country we are in, which is soon going to be a minority white country. It's already a heavily multiracial country. We already have a minority white population under 18. So this kind of notion that, like, one of the things I really explore quite explicitly in the book is I say, look, what is this look? We're moving toward a post-white America. That's just the reality. Whether people think that's wonderful, whether people think it's terrible, that's where empirically we are. So what do these norms look like? What do they need to look like in a post-white America where I think implicitly, as you just kind of teased out, there's a feeling that, well, there's sort of certain things that we might do in terms of how we treat minorities versus majorities that are no longer really descriptive, or certainly won't be descriptive in 10 or 20 years of the country as a whole.
I'm going to tease further, because let's say demographics weren't what they appear to be now. Because I think the moral question doesn't change, and the empirical question may not also be what we think it's going to be.
Right.
Although I don't think the massive growth in Orthodox Jewish demographics is going to do the trick here.
Right.
Especially because I don't even know if we're white. But assuming that it were not the case that whites were headed towards merely being a large plurality, but that they were a comfortable majority.
Yeah.
Wouldn't the answer be the same? Because to some extent, the answer you just gave is a bit of a situational or mercenary one. Well, we're going to be minority soon anyway, so that no longer applies. One response to that obviously is, well, but the majority of institutions and wealth are still overwhelmingly controlled by white people in this country. So it's not merely a numbers game. And the culture is still fundamental. I mean, we're speaking English. It's still fundamentally, you know, a European culture. I think the question is still the same, regardless of how it actually turns out. Don't you?
Well, I think in certain ways. I mean, first of all, at kind of a highest level, my argument is like just racial discrimination is wrong in the book. And that is not a situational or mercenary kind of answer to it. But then I do think that there are these elements that are situational that partially explain this kind of very odd position that we found ourselves in. And even they're kind of going deeper into this question. You have this very mysterious phenomenon. I'm not even aware of this in any other country, although it may exist, and it would be interesting to kind of look at, where if you kind of do these sort of advanced, more academic surveys to kind of ask people to rate the warmth that they feel toward their group and various other groups with respect to race, you find, totally unsurprisingly, that throughout every race and demographic group in the country, people have a certain amount of in-group warmth that they express, but it's not kind of like insane, or it's not out of the ordinary, and they don't express coldness for the most part to other groups. It's kind of like what you would call almost like a healthy level of typical ethnocentrism, right? Except one group. Liberal whites have a huge outgroup preference. They hate white people. I mean, to put it like not too bluntly, like they express a preference, a strong preference against white people. And it really stands out when you look at the data. And I think given the stranglehold of liberal whites and their allies on our institutions, I think it explains at least some of what we're seeing in America.
I think you're right, and I think a lot of people agree with that anecdotally. Is that preference, and I don't know exactly how the research was done, but do you have reason to believe that preference is something other than entirely sincere? It might even actually be an overcompensation for,
sure,
you know, for that. In other words, because liberals are, their consciousness is raised,
yeah,
they... I'm completely winging this. They hear that little voice inside them saying, "Oh, sit next to the guy, the white guy. You'll be safer with him."
Yeah,
and hate themselves for it.
Yeah, Well, I think one interesting piece of anecdotal information, and there is others, but I shouldn't say it's anecdotal. It was an interesting recent study done by a guy named Eric Kaufman out in the UK. You might have heard of. He's a multiracial scholar of race and ethnicity, and he's done some really interesting work, unlike a lot of the people who do this. But he kind of did a very elegant natural experiment that I won't kind of describe how he did it here, except to say that it's like a really robust finding. And what he finds is that despite the fact that liberal whites and conservative whites have these very diametrically opposed nominal experiences of how they're experiencing, racial preference or who they want to live next to or what they feel about their own group, when it comes to like the demographics of where they actually move, when they have to move, it's exactly the same. So liberal whites are basically a bunch of hypocrites, at least on that issue. And that, I think, is not surprising to any conservative of any stripe, that we sort of point these sorts of things out all the time.
I've also said, and I can't prove this, but if any one of these people who goes onto social media or says in the Yale cafeteria, I hate being white. I despise. If they were to wake up tomorrow morning and look in the mirror and see Jay-Z staring back at them, okay, one of the wealthiest and most successful men in America, they would head for the roof. The fact of the matter is, they can't imagine being anything other than white. I'm not saying it sounds unbelievable, because who would want to be black? Black people would want to be. It's natural. I mean, how much did you find when you're writing? Let me finish this. You have this Ron Coleman problem where you assume that everyone else knows the end of the sentence that you just said in your head. And I think you probably have this problem as well also, but you don't talk as fast. It's natural, I believe, based on my 60 years of observing human life, for people to feel, as you said, it's sort of an inbred ethnocentrism. I think it is I think a lot of people would agree with me. It's genetic. It is highly adaptive. As a general rule, our genetic inclination is to do things that will pass on our genes, and therefore genes that are like our genes are presumably going to be favored by the organism. And I'm always fascinated by these people who marry someone who looks exactly like a member of their family.
Yeah.
And they just keep perpetuating the same look in the same family, far beyond. That must really, the problem with this is that we're talking about primeval urges here. Right. And your white liberals want to think of themselves as being past this and being above this.
Right.
And I think that causes a real conflict. But at the same time, when you say they're moving into the same neighborhoods, what that means is they're moving into nice neighborhoods, into neighborhoods that are expensive to live in. One of my pet theories is that a lot of the performative wokeism, I'm sure a term that I'm sure you hardly use in your book because you don't write in cliches, but damn, it does capture a lot, that we see is premised on a living in a time of phenomenal abundance. So we can afford, the thinking goes, we can afford to hire people who aren't necessarily qualified based on objective criteria. We can throw out meritocracy. Let's not have the argument, is meritocracy really bullshit? Let's assume that there's such a thing as meritocracy. Sure. Why should we assume that? Because you and I both benefited greatly from it, and neither one of us was particularly connected. Okay, that's another podcast. The thinking was, it's not going to cost me anything,
right,
to demonstrate how liberal I am. And I keep thinking of, I get on a lot of these live streams, I fall into this crowd of Disney, what's called on the internet the nerd culture, the people who follow the comics and the Marvel movies. And I don't go to the movies, and I don't even particularly like comic books. I find them mostly asinine. And I mean, it's also fascinating to me. They're meant as substitutions for religion. And they come up far short. So, but they're really, a lot of them are reactionary. So I like to hang out with these guys, and they're talking about, you know, what DEI has done to Hollywood.
Sure.
And how, and what I keep saying is, at Disney, the thinking was, we'll make billions off movies forever. So we can absorb the cost of doing some really lousy movies to give opportunities to the underrepresented, et cetera, et cetera. Right. And what you find very quickly is that whether it's entertainment or aviation or medicine or the NBA, performance matters.
Sure.
You know, again, going back to this point about it's not going to cost me anything. I was talking to a friend of mine who had become a partner in a major Wall Street firm, which, as you know, on the one hand, you know, the old joke, becoming a partner in this law firm is like winning a pie eating contest, and the prize is more pie. Okay. But on the other hand, it's a lot of pie. They make a lot of money. But he saw, as a junior partner, that the senior people my age and older, were very comfortable bringing in, on a senior level, affirmative action candidates. In other words, people who were not qualified, could not do the work, paying them primo money so that it looked good for recruiting, and it looked good for DEI, and for their corporate clients who required quotas.
Right.
He said, as a junior partner, the screw ups that these unqualified people, they're not unqualified because they're black, but they're in this position of being hired for a position that they can't handle because they're black. That's just an empirical fact. I'm going to be stuck with this problem, not the boomers,
right,
but me, the 40-year-old young partner who is going to find that malpractice is being committed, or that I'm going to have to clean up the work of some unqualified. So I think the timeline during which that feedback mechanism operates turns out to be a lot shorter than people thought it would be. Even if they acknowledged in the back of their heads that it could ever happen. Because I think there's a school of thought, right? That if you give people who don't qualify on the numbers the opportunity, they'll step up, and you'll see, it's like the whole movie Trading Places, which was a great, hilarious movie.
Great movie. We're probably of the same generation to remember that as kids.
But I'm thinking now, well, the whole premise of that movie was anyone literally off the street could do the job of a commodities trader and make billions of dollars if you just set them up the right way. Turns out that's not true.
Turns out it's not. So I think we're in a situation where when you're kind of dealing with a performance deficit and it's 10% of the people that you're having to do that with, well, that's one problem and maybe a manageable problem. And when it becomes 60% of the people, or even 30 or 40%, it becomes much harder to deal with. And you kind of touched, Ron, in your statement about senior partners versus junior partners. I think that's the other thing. And it kind of applies much more broadly than just in a law firm context, which is the people at the top can afford to, as a form of almost conspicuous consumption, be very tokenistic about things. Whereas for the average person, even well above average, who's kind of doing pretty well, but maybe not at that very top, it's a concern. It almost reminds me of, there's a wonderful Tom Wolfe essay about a party that Leonard Bernstein holds for the Black Panthers in his room, and how they realized that they can't, of course, have their black servants at this party, you know, serving drinks and food. That just won't be acceptable. So they have to find these white Chilean servants. They're, of course, not going to go without their servants, but they've got white servants as a, because they're so luxurious.
Oh, because the Black Panther guests will be offended by...
Right, right. And it would just look very bad, right? But this is the way, of course, that the very, very top of the structure sort of looks at things. And of course, Tom Wolfe, ahead of his time, as he was on so many things, was writing about this in the late 1960s. I think he wrote this piece.
And I think that part of it, I mean, you know, I was harsh about your, what I called your mercenary answer, but I do think that a lot of the perspective of this does have to do with the sense that, what, you know, when we came to terms with the idea that we were going, the preferences were going to be okay because we were going to do the good preferences, not the bad preferences. There was just this sense, this sense of what could go wrong?
Yeah.
What could go wrong? And it was so conspicuous that blacks had been so profoundly discriminated against, and in many cases, brutally discriminated against, that some sort of morally brave stand really seemed to be the thing to do. Although, going back to your other point, it was hard, that moral bravery was hardly ever going to affect the people who were really in the driver's seat anyway.
Right. Well, I think that's right. And even beyond that, this is far more than a white-black issue. And though I certainly do talk about white-black issues a lot in the book, one of the things I really was quite at pains to do, because I think it's important in our increasingly diversifying in other ways group to say that there are groups like Hispanics and Asian Americans who have very different historical experiences here, who in some cases are getting the same preferences despite not having that same history, who in Asian American cases, sometimes they're on the wrong end of this discrimination as well. And in fact, one of the things I talk about in the book is there's some of this anti-white discrimination and racist policies that are specifically targeted at whites. And there are others that are just targeted at people who are doing well and are successful. And they actually hit Asian Americans even worse than white Americans in many cases, depending on the subgroup. But they're almost like the Asian Americans are made invisible in that process. So, and unfortunately also Asian Americans have chosen, for various bad reasons, I think, to at least institutionally be allies to that discriminatory regime. And I think it'll be interesting to see how long that persists, how long that is politically tenable within their own community to advocate for policies like affirmative action, for example, that tend to hurt their own communities pretty profoundly.
Well, my client and friend Simon Tamp found that out when during the, you know, the Slants case, he found that Asian American advocacy groups were opposing him.
Yeah.
And he said, don't you guys want to have the power to reappropriate as I am, you know, a slur? And they said, here's why we don't agree. Shut up. What's your outlook? Are things do seem to be moving. There is definitely, and I'm even in the last few months, there seems to be agitation. I would almost wonder whether you wish you had another, you know, a couple months longer with the manuscript, given what's gone on. But what do you see? What do you see happening?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the micro sense, things are improving, only because they just couldn't have gotten more ridiculous. And as we're taping this, I know it'll be a little bit later when it airs, this kind of woke Google AI thing is in the news of, you know, they asked to draw a picture of a pilgrims and it's like three black guys, two Hispanics and an Asian, you know, and their tri-corner hats.
It's so over the top bad
that
you'd think that someone had trolled them. You'd think that because it's so blown up in their faces. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, you frequently look at this sort of stuff now and you sort of say, you know, am I being trolled here or is this real? I mean, is this really what you intended to do? So I think in the micro sense, things are improving because it just got so ridiculous that, I mean, unfortunately, I tend to view that it's more of a ratchet effect. The ratchet just turned as far as it was going to turn at this time. So now they're kind of dialing it back a little bit. But I don't think until kind of white Americans are not too broad-minded to take their own side in this quarrel, I don't think we're going to fix the fundamental problems of anti-white discrimination and anti-white racism.
And so when you also,
what I want to do is make that as politically toxic as other forms of discrimination and racism are correctly in our society. And I have an analogy I do in the book where I kind of talk about the Cold War idea of mutually assured destruction, which actually kept the peace really well during the Cold War, the idea between us and the Soviets that neither of us were really going to do a first strike because we both knew how that ended up and it wasn't going to work out very well for any of us. I would like to take that view where expressing these sorts of anti-white sentiments, putting in anti-white policies, just becomes so politically toxic because there's an actual organized constituency that will no longer put up with it, that everybody decides, hey, you know what? Let's go to a content of their character standard as a much better way of kind of navigating through this multi-ethnic, multi-racial country that we live in. That's really the more moral position to take, and it's the more practical way that we're going to get through this as well.
Well, I think you're right, and I believe we are able to discuss this in a way that we couldn't have discussed it 30 or 40 years ago, because any assertion of how about the rights of white people was tinged for people my age with, well, that's something George Wallace would say.
Right.
That's something, you know, that a genuine bigot would say. And what's happened is, by racializing all discourse,
right,
we have made whiteness something that's okay to talk about, because right. if it's language and labeling that is all right to use negatively, then nonetheless it's part of the discourse.
Sure. No, absolutely. And I think there will be, I mean, I hope I've gotten really positive comments on the book. I mean, Tucker Carlson, Victor Davis Hanson, Heather McDonald, et cetera. A lot of white people. I do have actually also a very nice blurb from the longest serving member of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, who's an African-American, Peter Kirsten. That was terrific. But anyway, I mean, a lot of people have liked this book, but there will be I'm pretty darn on the right, but there will be some even further out there who will say, oh, well, you're trimming your sails too much. And look, I mean, there's an element of sensitivity you have about writing about any of these issues. But I think my bigger point in writing the book is that I want this to be a mainstream thing. I don't want this to be something that is only talked about by like a non-groiper, you know, whatever. And those are the only people who can discuss these issues, and it's sort of self-marginalizing. My point is, the things that I'm saying we should do, I think they're mainstream things. I don't think they're weird things or wrong things. And they've been outside the mainstream for too long. And I think they're getting into the mainstream, and that's exciting. And I want to put them further there with this book.
Well, I hope that works, because these are divisive and really central issues. And if in fact you accept, and I think you have to, the premise that the majority of operative institutions in this country and the culture and the money are operated by white people, you simply have to fix the mentality of white people. It's got to happen with respect to everything, including white people, because the non-elite white people are already, I believe, and I don't say this from experience, because I think for cultural reasons and other reasons, perhaps I might be considered an elite white people, but non-elite white people are feeling pretty damned alienated. And this idea of being made to feel guilty because of something your great-great-grandparents did, or more likely people you're not related to at all did, absolutely bananas. So, Jeremy, we could talk about this obviously for hours. The next time in Bozeman, I guess we'll have to do that. It's been great talking to you about this. And of course, the book, it's not as of this moment, it's not out yet, right?
It is not out yet. I don't know when this will end up airing, but it is out April 23rd. You can pre-order it today. And, you know, again, it's a good book. It's called The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. And it's available at bookstores and online near you. So
great talking to you.
Thanks so much, Ron. It's a pleasure to join you.
Hey, thank you for listening to the Coleman Nation podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. If you like the show, please rate it 5 stars and leave a review. For more information, please visit the show's website at coleman-nation.com. That's coleman-nation.com. Or you can visit my blog at likelihoodofconfusion.com. Join us next time on the Coleman Nation podcast and have a great day.